Well, I'm surprised to see so many of you sitting here. I know what it's like outside, and it's really tempting. It's a pleasure to be here. I grew up for much of my boyhood very close to here, about 4 miles on the other side of the border. So I feel right at home when we come back through here. Oh, wrong button. There we go. So I want to start very quickly with this. If we want to, anybody wants to talk about this, I'll do it later, but this is not part of, this is the background. Atmospheric greenhouse effect warms the surface of the Earth by about 30 degrees Canadian. you missed that this morning. I thought it was great. Adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere makes the surface warmer. There's simply nothing else that can happen. That's the fundamental physics. Human activity is increasing the concentration of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. We've increased by about 40% since 1850. I'll show you that in a minute. CO2 concentrations are now higher than any time in the last 800,000 years by roughly that same amount. Earth's surface temperature is increasing, especially since about 1975. Adding more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere is going to warm the planet further, most likely about 2 to 4 degrees centigrade globally by the end of the century. Whenever you see these global numbers, multiply them by a factor of 2 to get the rough rate of rise in the Arctic regions. Here's a graph of CO2 concentrations that goes back 1,000 years. So these concentrations down here are obtained by ice cores. You can see they're very steady at about 280 part per million, which is the interglacial value during much of the Holocene. You can see this rise that starts to occur somewhere in here about 1850. When I made this plot a number of years ago, professors never make new plots. We just add little arrows on old plots because it's easier. We were at about 370 or so. Well, we're now over 400 part per million and going up at about 2 part per million every year. This is a global surface temperature from a compilation by the Hadley Center in England. I could show you results from the Goddard Institute. I could show you results from Robert Mueller's program down at Cal Berkeley, and they would look the same. You can see this wiggly curve through here. The black circles are the annual averages. You can see this decadal type average. And you can see, particularly since 1975, we've been on this pretty steady increase. This arrow is roughly 1 degree of warming compared to where the planet was at the onset of the Industrial Revolution. If we project into the future using the climate model and think about where we're going to be, there's what we call scenarios, which are simply ways of expressing how we think society might respond in the future. If we continue at sort of the rate of acceleration, which we are right now, business as usual, by the end of the century, we will be somewhere up here at a global warming of 4 degrees or so. If we do an aggressive transition to green energy, we're going to end up somewhere in here about 2. If we make these drastic cuts, we might end up in here about 1. Now, this 0 point, by the way, is 1900. Remember, by 1900, by 2000 is a 0 point. By 2000, we'd already got about a little less than a degree of warming. Okay, so why do I put this up here? Well, this is really what you want to get to, which are the climate projected impacts. We're already seeing the disappearance of Glacier. I often show students in my class a picture of Glacier National Park, and I say soon to be not Glacier National Park at the rate things are going. We are already seeing damage to coral reefs because of warmer water. These kinds of things are all pretty much predictable from a warmer climate. Okay, so in 2015, we had the Paris Climate Agreement. The nations of the world, there's only one notable exception who we won't name, has agreed to limit global warming to no more than 2°C. Maybe it's appropriate to say 2 Canadian because we'll know who the other one is, maybe even 1.5. And so I love this quote because it's so science speak. We find that barring unforeseen and transformative technological advancement, they could have just said, barring a miracle, all right, we are not going to make it. All right, this is what this says, because this, we're going to need, without this miracle, we're going to need anthropogenic emissions need to peak within the next 10 years to maintain realistic pathways to meeting these Paris Accord agreements. We are not going to get there on the trajectory that we are currently on. Okay, so climate engineering, how does that fit into the picture? Well, here's a simple way to visualize this. Well, come on. Sorry. Having a little trouble with the buttons. Here's a climate system. Here are human actions that cause climate change, and here are the climate impacts. So this is sort of a little box diagram of stuff I just showed you. You can look down here, and this is how we think about it in terms of what are we going to do. Mitigation means we're going to try and do something about the human activities. We're going to try and limit these CO2 emissions. Adaptation means, well, whatever happens, we're going to adapt to it. All right. Well, climate engineering says maybe we can do something in this box of the climate system itself to do something about what we're talking about. And I'll come back to that in a minute. I did want to put on here something which a friend of mine made a point of, is that involved in all of this is suffering. All right. Now, you can suffer now, you can suffer later. But there's going to be suffering because adaptation and mitigation are not going to come without some amount of suffering. Okay, so climate engineering basically separates into two things. One of them is trying to remove carbon dioxide. I'm not going to talk about that today. I'm going to talk about this side up here, which is solar climate engineering. And the simple way to think about this is if we are heating up the system by adding carbon dioxide to it, and we are, because nothing else is going to happen when we add CO2 except make the surface warmer, we could cool down the surface by reflecting solar radiation. All right, so we could try and compensate. So we could try and engineer the system to suit ourselves. And you're all going, this guy's crazy. The more you think about this, the less crazy you feel. That's all I can say. All right. So what's the role for climate engineering, geoengineering? This is a slide I swiped from a friend of mine. So here's the business as usual curve. So if we cut emissions aggressively, we end up on this curve of climate impacts. Just think about this as temperature. So the planet doesn't warm up as much, but it's still warmer than we would like. So we think about, okay, we can do carbon dioxide removal. We can take carbon dioxide out of the system and we can cool it down. But the problem is that there's a long time scale going on down here. And this is a long time scale process for us to make this kind of stuff work. And so maybe what we can do in the meantime is add some amount of temporary solar reflection to keep the planet from getting too hot while we're figuring out how to get rid of the CO2. So what I want to stress here is that this is temporary. The only problem is temporary here is 50 to 100 years. All right. And it's not a long-term solution. The long-term solution to the problem we have is getting rid of carbon dioxide. And if there's any of you interested in the ocean, I will tell you that's my biggest concern about not getting rid of the CO2 is the acidification of the ocean affecting the communities in the ocean. Okay, so there are two ways there are two ways that we've thought about practically cooling the planet. One of them uses as an analogy volcanic eruptions. This is Mount Pinatubo erupting in the Philippines on June 15 of 1991. This is a picture taken shortly after that from the space shuttle showing layers. Here's the clouds in the tropics reaching way up into the tropical atmosphere. And here are a couple layers of solar radiation, or aerosol, that are reflecting solar radiation. We know that this cooled down the planet. All right. Happens every time a volcano goes off. So the concept is to use high altitude aircraft to inject particles into the stratosphere. Particles spread around the globe in a few weeks to a month. The particles then spread through the hemisphere of the globe in about 6 months. There's a lifetime of about 4 years for particles that are put in the atmosphere. So you got to keep sort of replacing these things on a yearly basis as they fall out. But you could cool the planet. Okay. The other idea. Okay, the other idea is this one. So the darkest planet, the darkest surface on the planet is the ocean. The brightest objects on the planet are clouds. So if I can make clouds over the ocean brighter, I can cool down the planet. All right, so the question is, can I make clouds over the ocean brighter? And the answer is yes. The physics is a little complicated, and I'm really sorry. If I'd known that Sam was going to give a talk on the Navier-Stokes equation, I would have pumped in the equation of radiative transfer right here to show beauty. You know, but sorry, I didn't realize that. So what we're talking about is down here, and I'm sorry for you if you can't see this, but the idea is that on every cloud drop has to form on a little particle nucleus. All right? And over the ocean, there aren't very many nuclei because the air is clean. So you get clouds that have a few large drops. But if we added droplets, we would get a lot more smaller drops, and they're more reflective. That's where I need the Navier-Stokes equation, but I mean the radio transfer equation. You just have to believe me. So the idea is we would use a fleet of robotic ships. We'd add, here they are, running around, pumping salt. We would add salt particles to the atmosphere below the clouds. These would get into the clouds, and there we go. We'd make brighter clouds. We actually know this works. I didn't put a whole bunch of pictures in here, but if you go home and pull up your browser and Google ship tracks, you'll see these pretty linear features in clouds that are the result of ships going underneath and pumping stuff up. Okay. There's some lag time here between me and this thing. See? Stop it. Okay. So regional climate change. Part of the attraction, if you do the stratospheric stuff, it's kind of a blunt instrument, right? You're going to put these things, they're going to go around the Earth, and your amount of control you're going to have is pretty limited. The marine cloud brightening is much more local. So one could even think of cooling down local, even if you weren't being able to do the whole global thing, you could cool regional areas. So you could maybe cool the water over the Great Barrier Reef and help the coral out. You could maybe change precipitation patterns on the coast of California and help the redwoods out. We don't know that this will work. It's an interesting idea. Okay, so now let's move off of the physics a little more into thinking about some of the related issues. This is a diagram from a paper that I wrote with an ethicist in the philosophy department. I co-teach a class with an ethicist. That's pretty entertaining. First thing we have to do is learn how to talk to each other. So here's a spatial scale and here's a temporal scale. And most of the discussions about solar climate engineering end up talking about the ethics of deployment. What I keep trying to stress to people, however, is this is where we are. All right, we're really talking about the process. We're trying to understand whether we actually can do this beyond just the conceptual idea. And if we think about a timeline, the timeline here that we're talking about is probably 20 years starting now to know enough to think that we could actually do this in deployment. I also want to point out that, to use a religious term, I'm an agnostic on this. All right. I am not telling you we're going to do this. I'm saying we need the information to find out if we should do this, and it's still going to take us 20 years. Okay, so right now I talked about these two different methods. There are actually two groups working on this. There is a group at Harvard University that is proposing to run a balloon experiment in the upper layers of the lower layers of the stratosphere, to look at spraying something out and seeing if they can track it and figure out what happens to it. And our group at the University of Washington is looking at this cloud brightening thing, and we've actually developed a spray nozzle that generates about a trillion particles per second, which is the, now we only need about 300 trillion per second to make this work. So we're working our scale up, but okay. So now let's back off a minute and reframe this question. Scientists have a tendency to get sort of locked into the first circle up there, the one that says, can we do it? But when you start talking about the kinds of things that I'm talking about, there should be something running through your mind that says, wait a minute, should we be doing this? That's an ethical question. It's why I work with an ethicist. It's why I co-teach with an ethicist, because I think that answer is really important. A week or so ago, I was in Washington, D.C. at a meeting of a bunch of people who are concerned about governance. So that's the question of, suppose you think you can do it, you think you should do it, how would you do it? And the analogy I always give here is the thermostat in our house. Our kids are grown. It's just my wife and me. Wintertime in Seattle, you know, so nice. So one of us turns the thermostat up and the other one turns the thermostat down. And one of us turns it up and one of us turns it down. And if you want to know who turns it down, is the one who pays the bills, and that would be my wife. All right? So the question is, you know, what do these ethical issues look like? Well, here's an example of some of them. So This one up here is called the moral hazard, which is sort of a weird name for something that makes perfect sense when you think about it. We really want people to change their behavior. We want to address the emissions, but what we're doing is we're giving them a technological fix. And so you go, well, if those guys can fix it technologically, then I really don't have to look at the moral value that I should be looking at. The issue of hubris is one which is really, I think, right in a sense at the core of this. And I'll come back to that in just a little bit. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with Greek mythology. I said I grew up much of my boyhood here. We didn't have a television because two of the three TV stations we could get were from Canada. It wasn't baseball. There was only hockey. What was that? So I read a lot. And my mother had this book of Greek mythology. And so I read it from cover to cover. So when we think about hubris, there are two stories that explain what I'm talking about. One of them is Prometheus. Prometheus is a guy who stole fire and he wasn't supposed to have it and the consequences were not good. The other one is Icarus. All right, Icarus had wings and they were held on by wax. And that was all good until he got kind of out of control and flew too close to the sun. So you can think of hubris in two ways. One of them, you're messing with a technology you shouldn't. And the other one is, well, you're messing with a technology you don't know enough about. Lesser of two evils. We're often confronted in discussing this with the idea of do no harm, the sort of precautionary principle. My reaction to that is you're too late. We are already doing something bad by allowing CO2 to increase. So now the only question is, what's the lesser of two evils? And are you allowed to do an evil that you view as lesser as another evil if they're both evil? And you want to get your head hurt and start to go that. Down here on the bottom is the justice in our times. This is an issue of the North-South, global North and South, the people who are responsible for it, which are mostly the countries in the blue there, and the people who will suffer the most, which are the countries in red. And finally, there's a whole intergenerational issue. What am I leaving to my children? I have lots of good stories about that, but I see we're a little short on time. So some possible responses to this kind of research. One is don't play God. All right, nature's good. Don't mess with it. We don't know what we're doing. And this one here that says a framework, this is from a stem cell paper. This framework comprehends the stem cell debate by first imagining undesirable and unforeseen consequences of stem cell research and working backwards from these undesirable features to regulate present-day research. A lot of people thinking about what I'm talking about work from this particular view. Bad things are going to happen, so how do we regulate it so bad things won't happen, which means they won't happen. An intermediate view might be testing the waters. What do we need to know? What would we do if we got the answers? Would we proceed differently if we knew the answers? And if we didn't know the answers, how does that work? And finally, there's one that I'll call beneficence, that we can benefit the world by doing solar climate engineering. The potential benefits to ecosystems include limiting damage from warming, preventing sea rise, and therefore makes it a good thing. And you can imagine, you know, this is some sort of multidimensional space and you can land yourself in a variety of ways. So a little while ago, I ended up having a discussion with two people, Forrest Klingerman and Kevin O'Brien. Kevin's a professor of theology at Pacific Lutheran. Forrest Klingerman's at Ohio Northern University and is an ethicist. And we wrote this paper on character and religion and climate engineering. And we got into this by discussing this issue of the two evils. And so we propose that religion can be a guide for finding an answer to the question, what kind of character should we seek in the climate engineering research community? And the first thing you have to ask yourself is, well, what in the world are we talking about? Well, character is an aspect of one's identity that persists over time, solidified by the habits and reputation. In other words, one's character is made up of the qualities, the what, that one holds over time, the who. And we ended up identifying in this little article three characteristics. And we deliberately chose different religions to emphasize where we drew these from: responsibility, humility, and justice. And we said these aren't exclusive. These are simply three. They're not trying to exclude anything. These are three things which come to our mind when we think about what people need to know. How should we view character and where are we going to get these definitions from? I'm going to leave you with a couple thoughts to ponder and some reading if you'd like. Global warming is real and it will have serious negative consequences. I can refer you to two publications. This one is from the Christian Reformed Church. It was adopted at the Synod of the Christian Reformed Church in 2012. It's a little long. I helped write it. So you can't stop some people. The chair of our committee was Cal DeWitt, who some of you may know, a very eminent ecologist. And Cal and I worked hard with a group of people on putting this together. This one was a report adopted by the National Association of Evangelicals. The main author is Dorothy Borse, who's a biologist at Gordon College. And I also had a piece of this one working with Dorothy on trying to explain climate change. I recommend both of them. This is a more, the Christian Reformed Church one is more theological and technical. The National Association of Evangelical Reports is more on justice. Okay, so leaving you with some thoughts. The consequences of global warming are going to provoke competition among societal values and are likely going to lead to political and social conflict. All we have to do is start thinking about water. Climate engineering offers the possibility of limiting some of these consequences and limiting the conflicts, but it raises some really difficult ethical and governance issues. And last, the Christian community should be playing an important role in discussing these ethics. And that's what Forrest and Kevin and I were trying to get to, was to say religion has something to say, not just Christian religion, but is so far largely missing from the debate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. We have time for some questions.
You're welcome. Okay. Right here. I don't know if it's on.
My question is kind of a very practical one. I just came up from Texas driving the whole way and paying $2.50 per gallon of gas all the way up to $3.50 by the time I got to Washington State.
You haven't bought any gas here, have you?
Not yet. But, you know, I know fracking has made the price of gas less expensive, and, mm-hmm. and a lot of us have been happy with that. And my question really is your climate engineering the preferred route to go because mitigation is so difficult to pursue because it's driven by economics?
So mitigation is the preferred way to go. Adaptation to me is the least way, the worst way to go. All right. The problem with mitigation is we have not been able to convince our political system that we need to do it. Scientists have been talking about this for 20 years. People say, why are you talking about this weird stuff? And I go, well, we're tired. We've been telling you for 20 plus years, actually getting close to 30 years, that you need to do something about this and nothing is happening. Why aren't the prices of gasoline higher? You know, why aren't we pushing renewable resources? Why aren't we? Well, it's because we don't have the political will, not because we shouldn't do it. That's the, you know, and this is part of the moral hazard argument, that we should be doing what we know we should be doing, but we're not. And is giving you a technical solution, making it easier for you to continue driving up from Texas saying, I like paying $2.50 a gallon for gas. When by rights, you should be paying a lot more if we were calculating the externalities. So the whole economics is we don't calculate the externalities. We don't calculate, you know, the atmosphere is the garbage dump, right? We just put all that stuff in the atmosphere and let somebody else worry.
I understand that there is some weather control operations going on in China. Is that more localized for the purpose of rainfall and agriculture, or do they have climate change aspirations in mind too?
They have climate change aspirations in mind, actually, but they're talking about regional climate. That sort of slide that I could have put the Chinese guys up on there. They've just started an announcement of this really big project to try and enhance rain on the Tibetan Plateau. And without going into why I think this, I think they are dead wrong about what's going to happen, but that's my day job of looking at atmospheric science of cirrus clouds. So there is the idea that you can, so two things here. One is a lot of this weather modification stuff is no different than what we're talking about. And so I've often talked with the governance people about, if you're going to try and regulate me spraying salt around, you need to regulate all the people who are doing weather modification who are not regulated at the moment. So that's one thing. The other thing is, yeah, we are talking about weather control in some sense. Not in the sense that I can prevent a hurricane, not in the sense that I can stop a particular storm, but in the sense that I can move that distribution of events. which is a little scary. That's the hubris part, right?
Question back here.
Could you go back to the slide with the National Association of Evangelicals?
Which one?
The National Association for...
Yeah, that one.
I think, when was that published?
Three or four years ago.
Right.
2011, thank you.
I remember back in the early 2000s, they also published quite a few articles on climate change. I'm just wondering...
On what?
That they published, the organization published a few public documents or reports about climate change or on environmental issues.
Okay.
So I noticed this is largely more of an American, or maybe not an American phenomenon, but I think it goes not so much at the technological effects, but I feel it's more about the cultural dynamics in the States about how to really bridge that gap, you know, in terms of mobilizing certain religious or evangelical communities in talking about climate change, because among the evangelical communities, climate change is often perceived as, you know, this liberal issue, right? So I'm just wondering, in your perspective, what are some of the solutions or opportunities to overcome these barriers to communication?
Well, I'm going to defer the answer to that question. I hope you're going to the talk tonight. Because the talk tonight, Catherine is sitting over there, and she doesn't know, but I get to introduce her tonight. But it will be great. And that's exactly what Catherine will address, I'm pretty sure, right? Communicating, yes. So we're going to leave that question. And you're right. In some sense, it is an American problem. It is a United States problem. And that's why Catherine and I, talk and worry about this. But it spills over to other places, too. It's not like other countries are devoid of this particular conversation. I spent 5 weeks as a visiting fellow in Germany, and I had some very interesting conversations at the institute where I was, talking about religious views of climate and climate change in Germany.
Time for one more question.
Is there really enough time to do solar engineering of this type? I mean, 20 years is what you said in the most optimistic scenario. It sounds like the planet's going to be in pretty big trouble by then.
Well,
or maybe I'm too pessimistic, but yeah, I see that.
Okay, so I'm trying to get back to this guy right here. So, you know, these are the projections, right? So we have a problem if we don't start working our way towards these, we're in trouble. So here's where I think we could be doing something. So if we could do something here, we still have some time to bring this curve down before it goes rocketing up.
But the vertical line's already at the second bar, right? That thing is from 2005. It's now almost 2020.
So. Yeah, we're already pushing the boundary. That's the point of this discussion of the Paris Accord, right? You can't get from where we are to the Paris Accord agreements unless you do something, and something is either drastic stuff now, or even being able to apply the cooling in 20 years. But one of the things I didn't say, the timeline is my usual joke, that timeline assumes timely and adequate funding of the research. I've been at this a long time and I've never had either one of those. So we'll see.
Okay, thank you very much, Thomas. Great.